Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 1 of For the Record program number 721, A Mosque in Munich. This program is being recorded on August 8th of the year 2010. Before we plunge into the main body of the broadcast, please use the SpitfireList.com website. I've got my entire life's work up there for download for free. And it is a compendium of invaluable anti-fascist information. Please utilize it now, by the way, featuring a blog. Periodically, I post a food for thought short commentary on a particular article or development, and then they begin feeding down the left-hand side of the page. Now, the title of this book, the title of this program, A Mosque in Munich, is taken directly from the title of a book that we're going to be using for this program, and it's also a book whose author I hope to interview in weeks to come. The book is a very important book. It's a must-read for anyone serious in researching the background of the growth of the modern Islamist movement. It also has some shortcomings, but then what in this world doesn't? A very, very important book. The book is authored by Ian Johnson. He's a former Wall Street Journal reporter, and indeed, the substance of the broadcast, much of it anyway, was anticipated by For the Record program number 518, which drew on a Wall Street Journal article from July of 2005 by Ian Johnson, which in many ways encapsulates and foreshadows the information in A Mosque in Munich. Now, the book was published in hardcover by Houghton Mifflin, and it's subtitled, again, A Mosque in Munich by Ian Johnson, subtitled Nazis, the CIA, and the Rise of the Muslim Brotherhood in the West. What we're going to be looking at in this program is the Nazi heritage, and then following that, the intelligence, especially CIA heritage, of the elements that were to coalesce into the modern Islamist movement. We're going to begin, we're going to spend much of the broadcast taking a look at Muslim peoples who were originally from the former Soviet Union and who had fought for the Nazis in World War II. And specifically, we're going to be taking a look at the charges of a fellow named Gerhard von Mende. Von Mende was a Nazi official, and he actually worked with the Nazi Party, and he was in charge of utilizing Muslim peoples from the former Soviet Union as combatants and also political propaganda vehicles in order to work against the former Soviet Union. After the military defeat of Nazi Germany, these same elements jumped to Western intelligence, including and especially the CIA and its offshoots. Gerhard Mende himself stuck with the West German government. We're going to be taking a look at the development of his parallel rival network of former Nazi and fascist collaborating Muslims. And he ultimately, von Mende, that is, wound up in a competition with the Central Intelligence Agency and its related organizations for control of the Muslim population, or at least for political control of organizations that profess to speak for the Muslim populations of the world, and this in the context of the Cold War, and utilizing those Muslim populations as vehicles against communism and against the former Soviet Union in particular. We're going to begin by taking a look at Gerhard von Mende's work in conjunction with the Prometheus League. Now, last week, most of you would have heard For the Record program number 720, which was an hour-long excerpt of AFA program number 14, the first of two AFA programs about the former World Anti-Communist League. And in particular, in AFA 14 and in For the Record 720, we were hearing about the Pan-Turkist movement. Many Turkic-speaking peoples were within the boundaries of the former Soviet Union. Many of them aspired to independence, either naturally, I guess one could say, or as a result of the repression of various elements of the Soviet government. Indeed, many of them had been oppressed by the Tsarist government before that. And some of them were just flat-out opportunists, and many of them, perhaps, if not against their will, certainly without any foresight on their part, wound up working with the Third Reich, including participating in many of its programs of atrocities. We're going to begin by taking a look at Gerhard von Mende's work with the Prometheus League. The Prometheus League, as we saw last week in an AFA 14, could be thought of as something of a pre-Wackel. It was a group of nationalities or people of ethnic nationalities within the former Soviet Union who were financed by various intelligence services for anti-Soviet activity. Ultimately, however, the Promethean elements, as was the case with Gerhard von Mende, were subsumed under the leadership of the Third Reich. Of Gerhard von Mende and his work with the Pan-Turkist movement and the Promethean League, and eventually the elements of the Promethean League that were subsumed into the Third Reich, we read from A Mosque in Munich by Ian Johnson. Von Mende now lived in the well-to-do district near Charlottenburg Palace, the Prussian king's old summer residence. The commute to the ministry took about half an hour by streetcar, much easier than crossing to eastern Berlin, where the university was located. The von Mende family had grown to four with the birth of a daughter and a son. Von Mende was given control of the ministry's Caucasus division, reporting to his old contact in the Nazi party, George Liebrandt. Von Mende recruited a group of men who had been in exile for years. Most were part of an anti-Soviet movement called Prometheus, named for the mythological hero who championed humanity by defying the god Zeus. It was founded in 1925 by men who had hoped the destruction of the Tsarist Empire would free their peoples from Russian rule. When that didn't happen, the Prometheus published and agitated against Moscow from Warsaw and then Paris. By the 1930s, the group was being backed by French, Polish, British, and German intelligence. The German conquest of France brought the group completely under German control. Von Mende had known and cultivated some of these men even before he worked for the Third Reich's Ostministerium. After the war, Prometheans such as Mikhail Kadia of Georgia and Ali Kantemir of Turkestan would play major roles in von Mende's entanglement with the United States. Kantemir would also become a key player in the Munich Mosque. One man would top them all in importance during and after the war. Veli Kayyum, the political activist who would address the Muslim soldiers, including Sultan, in the camp. Kayyum was initially unimportant in the Promethean movement, but soon emerged as the most prominent Central Asian exile following the death of Mustafa Shokay, who had headed a short-lived rebel government in Tashkent. To further consolidate his position, Kayyum added the honorific suffix Khan to his name. The Germans were delighted with Kayyum's rise in influence because he had been helping the Nazis since the 1930s. They considered him both loyal and trustworthy. They embraced the same vision to build Turkic Muslim armies that would fight the Soviets. Von Mende was a civilian, but as the war progressed, he was seen as essential to the Nazis' military success. In 1943, the SS chief Heinrich Himmler engineered the ouster of Liebrandt, von Mende's boss, in the Ostministerium. Himmler installed one of his loyalists, hoping to gain control of the rival ministry, but von Mende emerged from this shakeup unscathed. Indeed, he got a promotion, advancing from head of the Ostministerium's Caucasus Division to head of the Foreign Peoples Division, essentially overseeing the Ostministerium's entire policy toward Soviet minorities. The reason? Von Mende had hit upon an ingenious way of motivating the Soviet minorities, one that would echo into the post-war years. Basically, what that motivation was looking upon these minorities as something of a government in exile and looking to promote their eventual, at least nominal, independence as a way of retaining them as combatants for the Nazi cause. Still more about about von Mende and his, just to indicate, because von Mende was pretty much the scion. He was the father of the Muslim peoples who were put to work for the Third Reich. He was actively recruited by U.S. intelligence after the war. He declined to directly work with U.S. intelligence, although, as we're going to see, many of his Ostministerium associates did go to work for U.S. intelligence. Von Mender was a German nationalist, and he began using the former Soviet Muslims as a force in order to ultimately expand Germany's borders from the Cold War borders back to more like what they had been prior to World War I. And a greater Germany was one of the things that von Mende hoped to achieve through his use of the former Soviet Muslim minority populations. By way of understanding, though, just how deeply the Third Reich's policy vis-a-vis these Muslim combatants was, and how deeply the Ostministerium and von Mende were with the very darkest elements of the Third Reich, we're going to take a look at von Mende's participation in the Wannsee Conference in January of 1942. It was at that conference that the liquidation of the Jews was formally agreed upon and designed. Returning to a mosque in Munich by Ian Johnson, at a 1942 conference held at a villa on Lake Wannsee in a Berlin suburb, plans for the Holocaust took shape. Although the murder of Jews began earlier, the meeting brought the full might of the bureaucratic totalitarian state into alignment against them. Key ministers and Nazi officials attended. The meeting lasted just 90 minutes, but its message was clear. The state would now coordinate efforts in a single awful focus. The Ostministerium was represented at the conference. Von Mende's boss and pre-war contact in the Nazi Party, Liebrandt, attended on behalf of the ministry. Its officials had called for a definition of who counted as a Jew so the Germans could properly prepare the Eastern Territory for German settlers by eliminating Jews as well as other undesirables. 9 days later, the Ostministerium held the first of a series of meetings to iron out legal details stemming from the Wannsee Conference. Although the Nuremberg race laws precisely specified who was to be considered a Jew, the situation in the East presented complications. Poor record-keeping made tracing a person's origins more difficult, but the Nazis desired to kill quickly without careful deliberation. Many wanted a flexible guideline that would allow officials on the ground to kill as they saw fit. Von Mende was one of a dozen mid-level bureaucrats who participated in the meeting. The minutes do not set down any of his comments. Surviving Ostministerium records show no effort on von Mende's part to use his power to slow down the process or to raise objections. And he certainly knew of the genocide against the Jews by January of 1942. So again, by way of understanding the heritage that ultimately was to morph into the post-World War II militant Islamic milieu, both the U.S.-supported Muslim Brotherhood contingent, something we're going to talk about in future broadcasts, hopefully with interviews I would like to do with Ian Johnson. What we're focusing on here, however, primarily are the Third Reich Muslim alumni who were grouped initially under the Ostministerium, and now, as we're going to see, many of them jumped to Western intelligence, and others were retained by Gerhard von Mende for service to the Federal Republic of Germany. What we're going to look at now is the genesis of something called AMCOM-LIB. This was the first of the CIA and U.S. intelligence-affiliated organizations to employ many of von Mende's charges from the Ostministerium in large numbers. Again, AMCOM-LIB is actually a nickname for the American Committee for Liberation. It's described by Ian Johnson as follows. The group's name would change repeatedly as it struggled to find a title that would define its mission. Later in 1951, it became the American Committee for the Liberation of the Peoples of Russia. It was bad form to mention the USSR, which some of the group's members considered illegitimate. But the word Russia itself became a problem. It seemed too narrow because it excluded non-Russians who made up nearly half the country's population. So in 1953, the group changed its name again to the American Committee for Liberation from Bolshevism. That, in turn, seemed a bit quaint. Even in the 1950s, no one but the hardest core anti-communists spoke of Bolshevism, a term out of the 1920s and 1930s. So the last two words were dropped in 1956. leaving the group with a bizarrely generic name, the American Committee for Liberation. Outsiders often knew it simply as the American Committee, which gave it a wholesome patriotic ring. Internally, it was known by the acronym AMCOM-Lib. The term had as a delicious jargony mystique, perfect for an era that coined obscure and clipped nomenclature for military and espionage missions. AMCOM-Lib could have been a code word for a parachute operation behind enemy lines. Over time, AMCOM-Lib would command a large budget and a staff of thousands. Its main duty was to run Radio Liberty, but it had two other important tasks as well. It operated a supposedly independent think tank, the Institute for the Study of the USSR, which published papers by AMCOM-Lib employees and people close to intelligence agencies. It also had an emigre relations department that recruited agents, mostly in Munich, and then sent them around the world on covert propaganda missions. U.S. government involvement was carefully masked. AMCOM-Lib's board misled listeners and supporters in the United States into thinking it was run by emigre and prominent journalists instead of the CIA. When leaflets were printed, listing radio broadcast names and frequencies, the American role in the endeavor was purposefully obfuscated according to minutes of AMCOM-Lib board meetings. Perhaps for this reason, Radio Liberty never entered the popular imagination as it did its better-known sibling, Radio Free Europe. Although both were front operations based in Munich, the two were quite different. Radio Free Europe focused on Eastern Europe, Poland, Hungary, Czechoslovakia, and other countries dominated by the Soviet Union, while Radio Liberty beamed into the Soviet Union itself. Radio Free Europe's parent organization, the National Committee for a Free Europe, solicited funds from ordinary Americans and high-profile public figures sponsored it. It penetrated public consciousness to such an extent that decades later it inspired a hit song of the same name by the rock group R.E.M. AMCOM-Lib might have been relatively unknown, but it never lacked money. Its exact budget is hard to reconstruct, although some information has escaped the CIA's information blockade. Records show that in 1955, its budget was $2.8 million, roughly $23 million in 2010 terms. It grew to $7.7 million in 1960. And as we'll see, many of the alumni of Gerhard von Mende's Ostministerium and many of the Soviet Muslim minorities who'd previously worked for the Third Reich under von Mende jumped to the AMCOM-Lib group, including a fellow named Garip Sultan, who also went to work for the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations. The anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations, something we've talked about a fair amount on this program over the years, and something that's discussed at great length at AFA 14 and 15, was originally the Committee for Subjugated Nations put together by Adolf Hitler. It then received sponsorship from British intelligence and ultimately U.S. intelligence, specifically CIA as well. And as one of the people that we looked at last week, and we're to look at again this week, a fellow named Ruzi Nazar, nay Nazarov, actually represented the ABN at Wackel's 1984 conference in Dallas, Texas. And as we're going to see, many of Gerhard von Mende's Ostministerium Third Reich charges went to work for AMCOM-Lib and U.S. intelligence, including Garip Sultan, who'd fought for the Nazis. In the 1940s, Sultan had joined the Scottish League for European Freedom. Backed by Britain's foreign intelligence agency, MI6, the League tried to line up members of Soviet minority groups such as the Tatars to combat the Soviet Union. It led to a more durable organization, which Sultan also joined, called the Anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations. Both were largely the creation of British intelligence services and rife with von Mende's ex-Ostministerium collaborators. Now, Sultan was looking for something that paid a real salary, but that would allow him to keep on fighting communism. He found what looked like a perfect fit. Radio Liberty. One reason Sultan found it easy to choose Radio Liberty is that he already knew most of its employees. The station was organized into desks, unquote, each with a specific nationality, Russian and non-Russian. Programming concepts and guidelines were developed in New York, but the desks in Munich had autonomy to pick topics to cover and people to interview. This is not in itself unusual for broadcasters. The non-Russian desks, however, duplicated the Ostministerium's nationality committees in many ways, hiring similar personnel and even using Nazi ethnic terms such as Idel Ural to refer to Tatars from the Volga River region. The people on the desks had almost all worked for von Mende in the Ostministerium. Besides Sultan, other top-level Ostministerium employees included Aman Bedimurat and Veli Zunun on the radio's Turkestani desk, Hussein Ekran on the Uzbek desk, and Ejija Kirimal on the Tatar desk. The Ostministerium stalwart Abdul Fatili Bey ran the Azerbaijan desk. By the way, I am sure that I am murdering these people's names, but you can't win them all. My Turkophone capabilities are extremely limited, but it's the thought that counts. So again, that by way of looking at the extent to which U.S. intelligence simply took much of what had been put together by Gerhard von Mende for the Third Reich under the auspices of the Ostministerium and simply relaunched them or rebooted them in the post-Cold War period. Now, as I mentioned, although Gerhard von Mende himself was recruited many times by various U.S. intelligence agencies, starting with OSS, running on up through CIA, he himself was a German nationalist and remained committed to attempting to restore Germany's borders to what they had been before the Third Reich's military defeat. And so in this regard, he determined not to put his former Third Reich charges to work for the CIA or other Western intelligence services, but rather to put them to work for the Federal Republic of Germany. Now, in this regard, he worked very closely with the former German Minister of Expelle, Theodor Oberlander. We looked at Oberlander last week. He was a Nazi war criminal, an SS officer. He put together the Nightingale Group, one of the Einsatzgruppen, the mobile killing squads that were organized by the Third Reich on the Eastern Front to do its dirty work. The Nightingale Group was put together of members of the OUNB, the Bandera Group, and it did its dirty work in, among other places, the city of Lvov, or Lemberg, as it was known. And that was one of these towns that was at times in Poland, at times it was part of the Ukraine. But Theodor Oberlander is an individual that we've looked at great length in the past. We're going to look at him again here in just a minute. But Oberlander, after his Third Reich career and career as a war criminal, went to work as the Expelle minister for the German government. Ultimately, he was forced to resign when his war record came to light. But Theodor Oberlander was one of the Third Reich officials and later one of the Federal Republic officials who was most enthusiastic and most committed to using the various ethnic peoples from the former Soviet Union as vehicles for agitprop and even combat operations, ultimately to help to win the Cold War and in so doing to restore Germany's borders to what they had been. Ian Johnson writes about Theodor Oberlander in A Mosque in Munich as follows. And bear in mind that it was Oberlander ultimately who became the steward for those members of Gerhard von Mende's Ostministerium alumni, former Soviet Muslim ethnic alumni, who did not go to work for U.S. intelligence. Pretty much the rest of them went to work for the Federal Republic of Germany, Gerhard von Mende, and von Mende's superior and mentor of sorts, Theodor Oberlander. Ian Johnson writes about Theodor Oberlander as follows. Oberlander was the chief spokesman for these Vertriebene groups, the Expelle or the Driven Off. In the 1950s and 1960s, they fought a rearguard action against those West Germans who wanted to establish diplomatic relations with the Soviet Union or recognize the Oder-Neisse border. Oberlander headed a key political party that kept attitudes firmly fixed on loss and grievance. This was the same Oberlander who had participated in Hitler's failed beer hall putsch of 1923 and who had led one of the first Wehrmacht units made up of Soviet minorities. Born in the Baltic, he realized the value of the non-Russian minorities. He had participated in pogroms against Jews but opposed the Nazis' policy towards the occupied territories. Like von Mende, he thought Germany should be the non-Russians' ally. For that, he had lost his position in the party and his military command. That setback ultimately became a blessing after the war, allowing him to position himself as a victim of the Nazis instead of a party insider who had fallen out because of infighting. That, along with his party's voting power, was enough to convince West Germany's first chancellor, Konrad Adenauer, to make Oberländer the cabinet minister in charge of refugees. Oberländer was probably the farthest right member of the West German government, and in later years he came to be considered the personification of the young democracy's Nazi roots. The memo he sent to von Mende illustrated this far-right bent. He wanted Germany's borders redrawn, and he wanted von Mende's cooperation in keeping a firm grip on the assets he thought could help achieve that, the foreigners living on West German soil who had fought for Germany during the Second World War. Von Mende had most of the émigré groups firmly in hand. He financed Bulgarians and Romanians, Ukrainians and Czechs, but the previous year's events showed that he was losing control of the Muslims. Compared to AMCOM-Lib, his bureau was puny, and most of the Muslims were working for the Americans. Kuhnholm's trip to Turkey and Europe emphasized Washington's more ambitious goal, using Muslims in its global propaganda wars. Ultimately, one of the things, and we're going to cover this when I have opportunity to interview Ian Johnson, but ultimately the rival between American intelligence, CIA and AMCOM-Lib in particular, and Germany and German intelligence led to the financing of a mosque project. The idea was to build a mosque in Munich proper in order to help develop the Muslim community that was living in Germany and was working against the former Soviet Union. It was deemed to be important for ideological and community and spiritual purposes to have a mosque in Munich. The mosque project itself was highly politicized, and ultimately a rivalry grew up between the former Ostministerium charges of Gerhard von Mende and the Muslim Brotherhood, which was utilized successfully by CIA not only to gain control of the Munich Mosque, but also of many of the Muslim populations who were living in Germany at this particular point in time. We're going to skip over, however, the rivalry between Western intelligence and Gerhard von Mende and German intelligence during the war. Again, we'll cover that when I interview Ian Johnson. But what we're going to be taking a look at is some of the elements that were involved with the Western-backed Muslim Cold War phalanxes that were used against the former Soviet Union and which helped to spawn in considerable measure the modern Islamist movement, or certainly to fuel it and to help to swell its ranks. Again, please utilize the SpitfireList.com website. At this point, I've got all of my life's work up on that website. It is the greatest individual source for anti-fascist information in the world. It's got a whole mini library of old anti-fascist books for download for free. Several times a week, I update the Food for Thought section. It's got lectures. It's got a long article-length descriptions of broadcasts. It's a cornucopia. And if you're going to use it, tie a string to your leg and tie it to a chair, because you might get lost in that particular vast landscape of research. Also, there's a page to click on to support the work that I'm doing, and there's no better way of fighting back if you don't like what you're hearing than supporting the work that I'm doing. We're going to continue with this analysis on side two, and we're going to take a look at some of the elements from the Islamist movement, some of the Islamist elements nurtured during the Cold War by Western intelligence, and we're going to see how they fed some contemporary current trends. This, however, concludes side one of For the Record program number 721, A Mosque in Munich. This program is being recorded on August 8th of the year 2010. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.